license expired on July 31st. Ms. Grassard emailed the board staff regarding this issue, and staff supplied the instructions to reinstate and submit a renewal the following day. She self-reported the BACB on October 16th of 2023, which the BACB reviewed and considered the issue closed. Her license was reinstated on November 6th of 2023. On January 12th of 2024, the board accepted a recommendation from the committee to open a complaint regarding an allegation that Ms. Grassard failed to renew her LBA by the deadline. She continued to practice, as I stated earlier. To gain clarity, there was a request to ask for documentation regarding the extent to which she practiced while unlicensed. ML of Hope Ridge provided meeting dates with Ms. Grassard, but did note, as he noted in previous conversations with the committee, that he wasn't a supervisor of Ms. Grassard. There was a request for documentation indicating how much she did practice during that time of unlicensure, but to date the board has not received documentation outlining the amount of practice other than what ML provided us, which does not provide us that information. So that ends my review, and back to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Do any committee members have questions for Dr. Stenhoff? Okay, seeing no questions, we will move along. Ms. Grassard, are you and your attorney present? If so, please unmute yourselves for the record, and you are both free at this time to make a statement to the committee.
Hello, committee. My name is Angelica Davis. I'm appearing for Mandy Carvis representing Ms. Grassard. As Dr. Stenhoff already spoke, the committee is already familiar with the circumstances of Ms. Grassard's matter and that she unintentionally failed to renew while she was on maternity leave and returned to practice and rendered services to somewhere between 1 and 5 clients before she received notice informing her from Blue Cross Blue Shield that her license was no longer active. She did go she went to the Board of Psychologist Examiner's website, and it showed her with 2 license numbers, 1 active, 1 inactive. So she reached out to the board via email to inquire as to which one was valid, and she was informed that the one showing active was due to an internal error, and her license was in fact inactive. She submitted an application for reinstatement the very next day, which was on October 5th, the day after she learned that her license was inactive. And so by the 16th, she had inquired as to the status, and she now has set alerts so that she will not be missing the deadline in the future. And as far as the documentation goes, Ms. Grassard is no longer employed with Hope Ridge, so she doesn't have access to those materials at this point. That would have to be obtained from her former employer, which she's not able to do. So we ask that the board proceed with the recommended non-disciplinary action, perhaps a letter of concern, as has been done in the past when addressing similar issues. Ms. Grassard is present today and available to respond to any questions that the committee members may have.
Thank you very much. Are we to assume that Ms. Grassard's statement is coming through you and she does not wish to make a statement to the committee?
No, I'm making a statement, but she'll respond to questions if the board members have any for her specifically.
Okay. Do any committee members have questions for Ms. Grassard or Ms. Davis? I see faces, so I'm just allowing a little bit more time to see if those faces will formulate into a question.
I mean, I think, I mean, really the question I had, which is probably, I mean, it can be now or later in discussion, but I just want to, you know, at some point I want to hear from Ms. Gossard about, you know, what she's learned from this process and kind of, you know, I appreciate the calendar reminders and things like that. And I also appreciate the circumstances of like what she was dealing with in terms of being out on maternity leave, coming back. Like, I appreciate all those things. And, I want to hear a little bit about like what she's, you know, got going on to as kind of like a go forward basis to make sure that we're not missing those deadlines, you know, when circumstances occur. And then I think one of my questions you already answered, and that was that Ms. Davis, we were unable to get any sort of documentation from the previous employer.
No, we do not have any.
That's what I'm saying. You were unable to get to ascertain any of that, to obtain any of that.
I am not sure whether Mandy reached out for some, but I know that we do not have any.
Thank you.
Is it okay if I say something?
Yes, please. Yeah.
To answer your question, Dr. Davey, or I guess to give some input, I have learned a lot. Like you had just stated in the previous statement that you're a BCBA all the time, that it has been a learning experience, becoming a new parent, but then still upholding what I need to uphold. And it's been quite a process, but a learning process in continuing to be the best BCBA that I can be, as well as just moving forward. That currently, no, I haven't been teaching anybody. Like, I don't have any trainees, but it's moving forward to teach others in the future too. It's a good opportunity, but I can't say anything else besides just a learning opportunity through every meeting that I've attended. Just to make sure I have all the information and the definitions in order to move forward.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Okay. There is no complainant for this case. We would typically hear from the complainant at this time. This investigation was opened by the board. So at this point, I think we need to see if there is any discussion to occur and determine if a motion is necessary in relation to case number 24-27. Dr. Byron?
Yeah, just in terms of discussion, I mean, I understand obviously everyone needs to be operating under our license. That's where we need to be. But from reviewing the documentation, I do see someone who, once they were made aware of this, immediately took steps, not only reporting themselves to the BACB, but also getting in touch with this board to make sure that they were doing the things necessary to rectify. I am hoping too, there's some way that we can, from our account, make sure that we're not ever in a place where we have a licensee with two numbers, right? And how we can rectify that so we can prevent it. So I do think as this committee trying to kind of take ownership of that issue as well. But I don't see someone who maliciously came into this and tried to, I guess, slide something past anyone. I think it was an honest mistake. And once she was made aware of it, took the necessary steps to try to rectify it as soon as she could. I also appreciate the situation where she's in. If she's no longer employed at the agency that has those records and they won't give them over, I think you're also at a place where it's difficult to, you know, give us what we're asking for, and where she doesn't have any control of that situation. So from what I've seen from the documentation, I think she's given us what we would have asked anyone else to do, and the things she's not able to complete, such as the documentations for supervision and things like that. She's not able to get those things, but she's, to my understanding from Ms. Davis and from Ms. Griswold, they've tried in this warrant given those records back. And at one point, I don't know what else you can do as a former employee to get those. So I would just like to make it, I guess, public comment to say, I think that she once found the mistake, did due diligence to kind of rectify it.
I'll kind of tack on there a little bit whenever it comes to the fact that we have other individuals who are on this call who, you know, maybe you are waiting at this point to hear if your license is being moved forward to the full board for potential approval, or if there are any areas of remediation that are needed, but you are listening in at this point. There's a very important aspect whenever we look at the notifications that are sent from board staff. We have documentation of notifications that were sent to Ms. Gressard, as well as every other licensee when your license is about to expire. They are sent repeatedly. The contact information that you have with the board is where your information will be sent to. And those are courtesies of the board, but ultimately it's the responsibility of each licensee to know when your license is going to expire. So just, you know, understanding that, you know, make sure that your contact information is current with board staff, that you are following that responsibility of holding a license, so that those reminders that board staff send out are of benefit to you. So you don't end up in a situation where you miss deadlines and you are here. You know, I definitely just wanted to add that information in, that, you know, those reminders could have served as that notification rather than having to wait for Blue Cross Blue Shield to kick back and say, oh, you're not licensed anymore. Dr. Davey, I see that you had your hand raised.
Thank you. There's one other piece of information in looking at my notes that I thought we answered last time, but if the licensee would be so kind to just respond to me again, as it's going to help me kind of formulate a path forward. In terms of the brief period where you were seeing clients, and I forget, Dr. Sinoff, I think in your report you mentioned how long that time period was.
3 months.
Yeah.
3 months. At that point, you know, well, we cannot get information from Hopebridge. Was there someone who was your supervisor, and not supervisor in terms of like HR events, approving PTO? Was there a clinical supervisor that you did case conceptualization with, that you talked about progress or lack of progress with clients, or bringing on a new client and the types of assessments you would conduct, or a client you might be transitioning and what kind of transition plan was going to be put in place? Did you have someone providing you at a higher level clinical oversight, clinical supervision?
Yes, I did. All of those jobs that you had just mentioned were from my regional BCBA, who is noted in the letter there. I believe you said ML for the name.
But is he also the one that says he did not provide that? He did not provide those services.
So this is correct.
But you're saying he did, like he was not your HR supervisor. He might have also approved your PTO or your leave of absence, but he also provided clinical oversight in terms of case conceptualization.
He was strictly clinical. HR and anything PTO related was a different job, a different person, actually a couple people.
You've been getting the letters mixed up.
Dr. Davey, may I, or Madam Chair, may I?
Absolutely.
Dr. Davey, I'm looking at page 2 of the PDF.
Okay.
That might be helpful, but it, as you stated, it was noted by, I think it's, Mr. LeCossier, if I'm getting it close, indicated that he was not overseeing any clinical, and then I think over, if I remember correctly from previous discussions, he indicated that he was not providing clinical oversight either.
Is that the same one initials ML?
Yes. Yeah. If you look one bullet point above the where it says note, it gives his name there.
So is it your contention, Emily, that's Ms. Crisser, that statement by this individual is not correct?
I think that question was to you, Ms. Gressard. Am I correct, Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. That is this person, is he present?
I don't believe he is. Is he?
ML, no. Are you present today?
Dr. Davey asked if that statement that he presented was correct.
You see the statement, and I'll read the statement to you because I don't know if you have access, but and he says that he stated this in the last meeting, that he was not your supervisor in the sense of supervising her practice while her LBA was expired, but was her supervisor in the sense of helping her and other BCBAs with clinical or administrative barriers.
Yes. So as far as the process, if there were any clients that needed support, meaning there were difficult behaviors, attendance in parent meetings, just anything clinical, my first point of contact was Mr. LeCourcier. Anything outside of HR, it was a center manager or HR department. But there was a hierarchy of clinical operations that Mr. LeCourcier was the first step. And then there was a larger group of support within the company in order to help that the bigger the concern, as far as whether it's behavioral or any barriers, the higher up in the chain of clinical support that would be in attendance for those meetings.
Thank you. I know that each organization has different structures, so it's helpful to kind of get your perspective on who you would go to for clinical support. And so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Ms. Gressard, would it be, I guess I'd just like a little bit more clarification based off what Dr. Davey was just asking. Did you primarily have contact with your supervisor, ML, whenever you had a case concern, or was there additional oversight at across your cases, specifically the 1 to 5 cases that, you know, we're saying were served during that period of unlicensed practice?
There were additional contacts just as far as when to have like time slots, if there's anybody specific to see within that caseload. When coming back from maternity leave, a lot of it was case transition. But since there was not an official case transition, he was the point of contact in order to support, to make sure I had everything that I needed in order to do my job properly. So as far as he did touch base on other issues, just not necessarily like it was as needed in the aspect of what do you need, but when transitioning cases, it takes quite a bit of communication in order to do so.
That answers my question. We appreciate it. So committee members, just as a reminder, we are in the discussion point of this. I know that we've asked Ms. Gressard several questions here. Is there further discussion about this matter? Dr. Stenhoff?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Beyer, I think, summarized it well. It appears by all accounts that there was an attempt to rectify the situation. She obviously can't get the documentation from her prior employer due to the severance. So I don't know. I just at this point I'm going to just throw a motion out there that let's make a motion to dismiss at this point and move forward. So
I second.
Okay. So a motion has been made by Dr. Stenhoff to recommend to the full board a dismissal of this complaint. I made that amendment. I'm presuming that is correct, Dr. Stenhoff.
That's correct.
To recommend to the full board a dismissal of this complaint. It has been seconded by Dr. Byra. Is there any discussion? Dr. Davey?
My only discussion would be that I'm not super thrilled with the supervisor's response to us. And like, I get it, this individual no longer works for that organization. And I understand there may be some organizational constraints to being able to appear and have a discussion about a past employee. But, you know, just for the record and for my fellow committee members, the conflicting statements and kind of lack of response, you know, three, four sentences to us. In a matter here where, you know, a licensee is coming forward to have to explain their time and their interactions and their support that they received while they were with that organization, just seems pretty flippant and somewhat uncooperative. I'm not sure that was the intent, but that's how it comes across. And so I do wish that the individual would have provided us some more information to, just nail this and, nail this in the first 3 minutes of the conversation that this was a done deal. But that's the only discussion point I have. Thank you.
Dr. Byron?
Ms. Denton, you mentioned earlier that the email outs are our courtesy and ultimately we're responsible for our license. And I don't disagree, but just as I guess public service announcement for those who are going through the licensure process on this call, my other suggestion would be to add the board emails to your safe sender list. Because even though they go out, doesn't mean they go to your inbox as opposed to your junk. And if your inbox is like mine, I have 4,000 billion, quadrillion junks that I don't ever look at. So that's my last comment for kind of moving forward. Get yourself calendar reminders and also add the board to your safe sender list.
Absolutely. And I had my hand raised. I don't know how it disappeared because I want to make sure I go in order of who to be acknowledged here. So I'm going to acknowledge myself. I think that I have a little bit of a different perspective here than my fellow committee members who have spoken up to this point. I do appreciate that Ms. Gresser took steps to remediate the concern. However, I'm concerned about the period of unlicensed practice. We don't have documentation from the supervisor. We have conflicting statements between the supervisor and Ms. Gressard surrounding if there was appropriate oversight. I think in regards to the way that we have handled these situations previously, we have wanted that evidence from a supervisor, that there was that supervision occurring. And I know that we've accepted different aspects of that, whether it was a letter of attestation, essentially, that they have submitted, or whether that was, you know, documentation for every single supervision meeting that happened. You know, we haven't set a standard as far as what that would be. But I don't think we've run into a situation where we've had a supervisor who says, no, I didn't do that. So I am concerned about this. I'm not going to offer an alternative motion because we've got a motion on the table right now. But I'm not sure I'm in agreement with complete dismissal. Dr. Rates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was actually going to address both issues that you and Dr. Byra shared. So I wanted to also just indicate that making sure that you are attending to emails from the board and that you do have those tagged so that they come to your mailbox successfully and you do not miss them is very important. So I wanted to share that message as well. I'm wondering, Madam Chair, I think it's on page 2, but what I struggle with is it appears that we have a list of dates where the individual did provide supervision and the activities seem clinical in nature. So I think I also was having a hard time, but think that the statement from the supervisor ML and then the list of activities and dates don't really align for me. And so I guess would agree with my committee member's motion, just given that while there is a statement that wasn't provided, then there is this list of dates that covers the entire range of time. So unless I am misinterpreting that information, to me that seems like there is some evidence of clinical supervision happening during that time frame.
Ms. Pakkinen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I actually make my comment after the deliberation and the vote have been completed?
Okay.
Thank you.
Dr. Byra?
I mean, to be frank, I'm a little bit more concerned with ML's practice as a licensed behavior analyst than I am with Grizzard. I'm sorry if I butchered your last name. Really apologize for that. I'm more concerned with his, you know, Dr. Davies, you said, you know, he couldn't be bothered to write more than a sentence of, you know, I didn't really do that. Well, if that's your job description, you're supposed to be acting in a regional supervisor capacity. Granted, I know different organizations will label different job roles a bit differently, but if you were in a regional supervisory position, you know, ideally you should be responsible for all those cases that are under you. So I guess just for public record, I'm more concerned with his behavior as a licensed behavior analyst than I am with Ms. Griswold's. Grizzard's, sorry. Nope, still wrong. Grizzard, sorry again.
I would certainly agree that there's a concern about ML. You know, I think I've expressed kind of where I am in this, and I don't know that I have anything else to necessarily add to this. I'm thinking, and like I said, it's not a motion because we've got one on the table. I would probably lean closer to a letter of concern surrounding the unlicensed practice. I believe that's in line with what we have historically done in these situations. So, you know, that would just be my additional comment there, Dr. Davey.
So I appreciate everybody's comments on the situation. I think, you know, Dr. Ms. Nen, to your point that you know, historically we have done a variety of things in these cases, right? And I think one of the benefits of us speaking to licensees and other individuals that may have information around these particular cases helps us to make, you know, an informed decision as to you know, what course of action we should take. And there have been courses where we've done letters of concern. There's been courses where we've dismissed after getting information from individuals. And to me on this one, like the licensee in this case has done what they can do. And like, I agree, there was a time and a frame where there is some question, but we don't have jurisdiction over the agency to compel them to come and tell us all the things that we that help us, you know, fully adjudicate this. And with the information I have in front of me, that is the reason that I support the motion that's currently on the table, is those are the facts I have to operate with. And I feel the licensee has done a adequate job in coming forward with the information she can pertain. She's provided the contextual information around the situations that occurred. She's come forward in good faith. You know, I think that is the reason why in this particular case that I lean towards the dismissal. I don't see this as an ongoing pattern. I think the point has been made. I think Dr. Reyes or Dr. Byra, I have more concerns about the supervisor, but that's for another day. So I don't want to discount what you're saying, Ms. Nen, by any means. I agree with you. We have made those decisions. It's just in this particular case, I just see that we've run its course and we've got the information that we've got. And in this case, the licensee has done what they can to move us forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Baby. Is there any further discussion before we take a vote?
May I ask for a roll call, please?
Absolutely. So all in favor, say aye. Ms. Galvin, do you call the roll?
Madam Chair, Ms. Malice will call the roll for the vote. Thank you.
Dr. Byra?
Aye.
Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Ms. Denton?
No.
Dr. Reitz?
Yes.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Yes.
The motion passes.
Thank you very much. Okay. And to the licensee who is on the line, this is a matter that will be forwarded to the full board. Board staff will be communicating with you the date at which this will come before the full board. And any additional information that may be needed. If you've got any questions about that process, you can direct them over to board staff. Thank you so much for your attendance today and being available to answer questions. I think it has acted in your favor.
And Madam Chair, if now I can briefly make a couple of comments. I was largely reacting to what Dr. Byra mentioned earlier, which is, you know, what licensees can do, you know, extra due diligence in addition to complying with the statutory and rule requirements to maintain current information, contact information on file with the board. I don't have those citations in front of me, but they're easily found in statute and rule. Our licensee portal enables self-service anytime, any day, you know, for someone to change their contact information, which is a vast improvement over, you know, how we used to have to facilitate that. So in addition to, you know, adding to your approved your address book or, you know, approved senders and so forth, that of course is a best practice. The system does send multiple reminders for license renewal, so three in total at specific intervals. So, you know, it would be difficult, I think, for, you know, all three of those to elude anyone. And we spent a lot of time talking about this, of course. I did look at this issue just because of how much time, particularly the committee has spent on this. It seems to be, you know, not just specific or limited to behavior analysts, but many more behavior analysts allow their licenses to lapse and continue practicing past that expiration date than do psychologists for whatever reason. And I don't know why that is the case. I'm not prepared to speculate. But it is fewer than 0.5% of our licensees who struggle with this. So I wanted that, you know, just to make that aware for education purposes. And then also just to inform anyone who's listening that there will be a new solution, a new strategy, you know, a new mechanism, I guess, for reminding all licensees about the licensure due date with the email reminder that everyone should have received in recent weeks about the shift to the new CE reporting platform. That system will also send renewal reminders and CE completion recording reminders. So there will be a multitude of emails that come to licensees as long as they do their part, which is maintaining a current email address on file with us, of course. So I really hope that with all of these strategies, we're going to see fewer and fewer of these instances, but I'm always interested in hearing, you know, more ideas for how, you know, we can really mitigate what is a very time-consuming problem for this regulatory body.
Thank you, Ms. Pekkanen. Okay, Ms. Malice.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to give the next code word. The next code word is eclipse, eclipse. Thanks.
Thank you very much. All right, we will move into agenda item number 8, which I do imagine is why the majority of the people are on the call today. Agenda item number 8 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendation to the board pertaining to approval of behavior analyst applicants. We do have, as mentioned earlier today, 30 applications to go through. A committee member is assigned to each of these applications and will serve as the lead. And we talked about this last time. At our last meeting on, let's see, first maybe, where we discussed the introduction of essentially a clean list. Historically, we have gone through and reviewed in a little bit more detail which applicants have gone through what school and who their supervisors were and what all their supervision experience kind of contained. And, you know, in the interest of efficiency, of moving these applications forward more quickly, of getting people licensed in a more expeditious fashion, you will hear today again that there are some applications that have met the requirements essentially in the review, and it would be recommended to the full board for potential approval. So you will hear that process if you are on today, and maybe you've listened to previous committee meetings where that has gone through. And it is certainly not to not pay homage to the supervision experience of the applicant, but more so to get you guys licensed in a more expeditious fashion. So we will go ahead and kick off our review of the applications with applicant number one. Applicant number one on the agenda is
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Madam Chair, just I had requested that one of the applicants, Anise Soto, appear if she could today. And again, very well could have been that Anise, that he was here earlier. But if he is here, I'd love, if possible, I just had a question that, you know, I wanted him to respond to. So can we ask if he's possibly here so we do not miss him? We may have already missed him.
I'm here.
Very good. Okay.
There you go. Would you like to start with this application first, Dr. Davey?
If it pleases you, Madam Chair.
It pleases me, sir.
Thank you. So thank you very much. So in this case, in my review, my review of the file, which included the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and decorations, administratively, everything is in order. There's one note in here that when responding to our questions with regard to any felonies or misdemeanors, that there was an occasion on May of 2016, and then later in May of 2016 of a DUI, and later convicted of that DUI in January of 17. Again, I would point to the committee that this was almost 8 years ago, but I know it is a point of a process that we'd like to hear from licensees that have had an issue in the past that might raise some questions for this committee, to be able to feel as if we can move this to the full board for consideration of a license. And so I would just ask that Mr. Soto, if you wouldn't mind unmuting yourself and just kind of talking about the situation from 2016-17. And then, you know, really your statement was quite clear, but just kind of maybe elaborating on reviewing your statement and elaborating anywhere you feel that's appropriate. I would appreciate that.
Okay. Yeah, sounds good. First of all, I want to thank you guys all for letting me speak today. And I just want to clarify, so I have a double last name. So my last name is two last names. So it's Osorio Soto.
Oh,
there's a lot of confusion with that all the time. Yeah, so it's my full last name is Osorio Soto.
Thank you.
No problem. So yeah, so there was a lot of setting events during this time. I was going through a lot. I was in my first master's programs. I have two masters, one in marriage and family therapy, one in applied behavioral analysis. I was in the middle of my first program. There was just a lot of setting events, a lot of stress. I was a former undocumented person. And so there was a lot of stress with being undocumented. And honestly, I didn't take regard to it. I was young. But it was 8 years ago, and I've learned a lot from that time. I have a family now. And I've been blessed to have my wife. I have two daughters and my newborn son, who just was born a month ago. And so I learned a lot through this experience, and I know that like it was a mistake, and luckily it wasn't a costly mistake in the fact that it cost my time and money, but I am so glad that it didn't cost anyone's life, including myself or anyone else's. And I think that's the biggest thing that I learned through my time doing all the procedures of the DUI. I went to a Mothers Against Drunk Driving class that was mandated by the court. And I just, you know, in the past when I was young, I didn't realize how drunk driving doesn't just impact the person driving, but the people around them. And that was like my biggest awakening. Ever since then, I haven't engaged in drunk driving. You know, I did all my court stuff. I went back to school and I got the degrees I needed to get to become a board certified behavior analyst, became a BCBA, started practicing. And my goal is just to be able to move forward and move my family to Arizona, closer to my parents, so we could have a little bit more support with my kids. And yeah, the DUI, you know, it was a really hard time, but it helped me learn a lot. And going through all the hardship of the DUI, you know, I definitely don't want to go through that again. So that definitely is, you know, a factor in not engaging in that behavior again. But as well, you know, I flourished. I was able to pick myself up and bring myself to where I'm at right now. And honestly, I feel very successful in that. And I really hope that the board sees that, because this happened such a long time, because of all the changes that were made, that I'm able to move forward and be licensed in Arizona to be able to practice in Arizona.
You're muted, Dr. Davey.
And I just nailed the last name. Thank you so much, Mr. Osorio Soto. I appreciate you being here on short notice and coming and speaking to us. As I'll point out, you know, this was a significant amount of time ago, and with the statements, you know, I fully believe that we can move this forward to the full board for consideration. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all so much. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We will go ahead and just start back up at the top, and we will review Carla Sanchez, this application next. I am the lead on this application. Through my review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declarations, I find it both to be substantively complete and administratively complete as well, and would recommend that this moves forward to the full board for potential approval. Application number two is Catherine Hollerant. I am also the lead on this application. This is an application, just to remind fellow committee members, that was issued a FAIR from a previous review whenever it, whenever we reviewed this application on March 1st. The concern that we had here was that the applicant had been a BCBA / clinical director since October 1st of 2023. We had asked for information surrounding what that practice looked like, if there was a supervisor who was supervising this this applicant during that time. We had asked for a written statement surrounding the duties while employed at Montera Health Arizona during the time. The information that we got back whenever we requested this was from Jody Rumpf. I'm so sorry about that. It looks like the last name is spelled Rumpf. Hopefully, I'm not sure if Ms. Rumpf is on the line today. It should be noted that Ms. Rumpf is also an applicant on today's agenda, and is also seeking licensure in the state of Arizona. So there was a statement that was provided from Ms. Rumpf on response for Ms. Hollerant, stating that she had provided supervision, that supervision was inclusive of training and supervision above the BCBA task list, that she had additional training and supervision on peer-to-peer meetings, codes and definitions, letters of medical necessity, metrics and tracking of key performance indicators, training on proprietary applications and their use, as well as feedback and training on overall all areas listed on the task list. So it does appear that there was some supervision. The concern is that the supervisor who is providing this supervision is not licensed in the state of Arizona. I will go through Ms. Rump's application next. So I'm going to save some comments for that until we get to that next application. You know, I am going to kind of include my fellow committee members here as far as the appropriate steps to be taken. And maybe I'll lean on Ms. Galvin for some legal advice. It does appear that there was a period of unlicensed practice. There was not a licensed supervisor who was providing that oversight. You know, there, whenever Ms. Hollerand provided her response surrounding her job duties as a clinical director, she did make a statement in there that was, and lastly, once the operational setup and licensing was complete, then she led the development and implementation of ABA programs, treatment plans, working collaboratively with a team of behavior analysts and therapists to design individualized programs to meet the unique needs and goals of each client. So I was a little bit confused about that. Ms. Hollerand, are you on the line? I did want to see if I could ask you about that particular piece of your statement. I am not seeing. Okay, so, you know, just to fellow committee members, my question here was, you know, what licensing was complete? Is this like a future statement that we are anticipating that she's saying once she becomes licensed, that's what she was doing? I'm just uncertain. From what I have in front of me, it does look like there was unlicensed practice since October 1st of 2023. Can I have some input from my fellow committee members here?
Can I make a motion that we go into executive session for legal advice?
Absolutely. I will second that.
Second.
Okay. The motion has been made by Dr. Raitz to move to executive session for the purpose of receiving legal advice. It has been seconded by myself. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All aye. Opposed? Okay. Nay. The motion carries. It does look like we have all returned to open session. After receiving some legal advice, I do feel like I am ready to make a recommendation for this. I would like to table this application with the reasoning being I believe there's some testimony that would be beneficial to obtain from the applicant, as well as the next application that applicant that we're going to review, Ms. Boy howdy, I want to mix up this name, Rumpf. So as we are looking at this, I do think there is some clarification that I would like to receive before making any sort of recommendation to the full board. You know, we've requested the fair and we've got some documentation in front of us, but I do believe for the review process, I would like to subpoena or invite these individuals to the next meeting, so there can be some, hopefully some answers to some questions to address this concern of unlicensed practice for the last 6 months. Do I need to make that its own motion?
I think what you just stated was sufficient for a motion if there's a second.
Okay. Second.
The motion has been made by me to table this application and invite the applicant as well as Ms. Rumpf to the next committee meeting to answer some questions. It has been seconded by Dr. Stenhoff. Is there any discussion? Okay. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed? Nay? Uh-oh, did I freeze? No? Okay, everybody got really still. Okay, just checking. Looks like the motion carries. I am going to, just because we've been talking about Ms. Rumpf, move to her application next. And then we will start back at the top there. Let me scroll down to this application. Okay. When I was reviewing this application for Ms. Rumpf, you know, it is administratively complete. Ms. Rumpf is a licensed behavior analyst in Texas, in good standing since June of 2018. It does appear, based off the application, that she began services with clients in Arizona on May 15th of 2023. She was, you know, since she's an applicant right now, she was not licensed in Arizona at this time. You know, she, like I mentioned in the previous application that we were on, she reported in a fair for Ms. Hollerand. That she was, in fact, providing supervision to a BCBA, at least, in Arizona without a license. You know, so it does appear that there is a potential of unlicensed practice. And I think at this point, I would recommend that we table this applicant as well, since we have already invited the applicant. Well, we're already recommending that we invite the applicant to the next committee meeting to talk about this and to answer some questions surrounding this before we move it forward. That is a motion on my end. Is there a second?
Okay.
Dr. Davey, did you second? I'm sorry.
I'll second. That's fine.
The motion has been made by myself to table this matter and invite the applicant to the next meeting to answer some questions from the committee. And it has been seconded by Dr. Davey. Is there any discussion? Okay. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed, nay. Motion carries.
And that would include allowing staff to issue a subpoena.
Yes, ma'am. Okay, we will go back up to the top at this point and go to application number 3, Laura Vargas. Dr. Rates, you're the lead on this application.
Yes,
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. In my review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declaration, I did find just one administrative error on the supervisor's form. Question 11 indicates that the supervisor conducting the supervised work was a relative. That question was answered with a yes. I'm going to assume that this may just be an error, but I think we need to reach out to that supervisor to get confirmation and correction of question number 11. Otherwise, the application was complete. So if we can get that resolved, I would recommend we move that forward. Sorry, for my committee members, it's page 22 if you're looking to find that.
Okay, and board staff, I know we're going to discuss this on another agenda item here as far as what happens whenever we request information informally to kind of get to answering a question that could simply be a typo, you know. And so I know that, you know, for members of, well, not members, but attendees of this meeting, you know, we will be having a later conversation on the agenda today, what happens when we request that additional information as far as, you know, what the time frame is and what board staff are able to do and go through that. When we don't follow like a first additional request for information type of process. So we'll kind of circle back around to that. Okay, we will move on to applicant number 4, which is Shay Kowalski. Dr. Davey, you're the lead.
Thank you. My review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declarations. I find this to be both administratively and substantively complete. Thank you. I would like to see it move forward.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. We will move to application number 5, which is Karina Serrano. Dr. Byra, you're the lead on this application.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and declarations, I find it to be both administratively and substantively complete as well, and I recommend that it go to the board.
Thank you. We will move to applicant number 6, which is Alejandra Garcia Hernandez. Dr. Rates, you're the lead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. I was freezing a little bit, so I wanted to make sure that was resolved. My review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declarations, finds it to be both administratively and substantively complete, and I would recommend that we move it forward.
Okay, we will move to application number 7, which is Brittany Wrightington. Dr. Stenhoff, you're the lead.
Thank you. My review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and declarations, I find it both to be administratively and substantively complete and recommend moving forward to the board.
Thank you. Okay, we will move to applicant number 8, which is Sydney Cardiff. Dr. Byra, you are the lead on this application.
Okay, so for this one, unfortunately, I did find an issue. So supervision was all completed in the state of Nevada, but not all of the supervisors who did supervision were licensed in the state of Nevada at the time of supervision. So according to statute 32-209.1.30, it states that if experience was obtained in a state that licensed behavior analysts at the time of the supervision work experience, the supervisor must be licensed in the state where the behavior analysis trainee services were provided. So going through the total number of supervision, if we take away the hours that were provided by supervisors that were not licensed in Nevada, the total number of supervision hours is 1,471.5, which is not enough hours to meet our 1,500 threshold. So I am wondering, since that time, if there have been additional hours that have been supervised past certification, if it would be appropriate to suggest a fair so that we can give Ms. Cardiff an opportunity to provide that difference of 28.5 hours. And then if we can have that documented, then I don't see any other issues with moving it for approval.
Well, Madam Chair, I do see the applicant is here, so the committee may wish to see if she has any questions or provide her with the guidance ahead of what is the formal process of the fair.
Absolutely. I did see that Ms. Cardiff unmuted herself momentarily, so I do anticipate that she may have some questions.
Yes. So still in contact with my supervisor, who I got most of my hours while getting certified, and have had discussions and further mentorship from him. So would I just need a form stating that I have additional hours signed by him to submit to the board, or?
So what will happen at this point is a fair will be issued to you. This is a first additional information request. So what that is board staff will send you a letter detailing what they need from you. And, they will identify for you the timeline by which you need to get things in order to be considered at the next meeting. But we would need some additional information right now. And it very well could be that if you have documentation of a supervisor who was licensed in a state where you have been practicing, who has been meeting with you and discussing clinical cases, and you've got that, then they may be appropriate to complete an additional form to submit for that. And I would anticipate, since it is such a small number of hours that you would need to hit our 1500 mark, that hopefully, even if you have not received that additional aspect, you could, 28 hours and probably very, very soon. So anyway, that is kind of the process. You'll get a letter. Board staff will outline for you exactly what you need to do. And hopefully that will be of assistance and guidance to you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we will move to application number 9. Application number 9 is Sarah Robbins. Just to remind committee members, this is an application that came forth on March 1st, and we issued a FAIR for this application. And at this point, we were asking about the time of employment at Evolve Behavioral Services. We had asked about, what supervisor they were practicing under whenever they were serving in Arizona. We asked for an attestation from the supervisor. We asked for a detailed written statement, including the duties at Evolve Behavioral Services. There was a correction actually made to this application after the FAIR was submitted. It was an error on the applicant's behalf. They were not practicing in Arizona. They were practicing in a different state. The zip code was correct. The state was not. So with that being said, there is not a concern that I have at this point about the individual practicing in Arizona without a license. And so with that information to be said, let me, my review of the file at this point with corrections, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declarations, finds it to be both administratively and I'm still botching this word. I can't remember it. Substantively. Yeah, shaking heads. Okay, complete. So I recommend that it moves forward to the full board for potential approval. We will go to application number 10, which is Mordecai Liefer. Dr. Byra, you're the lead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So my review of this record, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declaration, I find it to be both administratively and substantively complete. And I recommend it goes to the board.
Thank you very much. Okay, we will move to applicant number 11, which is Andrea Van Horn. I am the lead on this application. This was also a FAIR that we had issued to the individual. We had requested some additional information surrounding the supervised experience that had occurred. Just to remind fellow committee members, this was an applicant who had come forth with a large chunk of their supervised experience coming from a licensed psychologist in the state of Tennessee, I believe, or maybe it was in Missouri. It was in Missouri. So whenever we look through our statutes, you know, we do require that, according to, R4-26-404.2, that there needs to be 1500 hours of supervised experience that meet Arizona's requirements. And so with that, we had asked if there were any additional hours to meet that 1500 hours to get up to the requirements in the state of Arizona. The applicant did supply an additional verification form for the additional 482 hours, which does appear to meet what was needed. It covers the time frame that was there by a licensed behavior analyst in the state. So at this point, I no longer have concerns about meeting that 1500 hours. I believe that it is administratively and substantively complete, and I would recommend that it moves forward to the full board for potential approval. We will move to application number 12, which is Renee Bass. Dr. Stenhoff, you're the lead.
Okay. My review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and declarations, I find it to be administratively and substantively complete, and recommend it move forward to the board for approval.
Okay. The next application is Zachary Giertich. I am the lead on this application. I would like to recommend, make a motion that we move to executive session for the purpose of receiving legal advice.
Second.
Okay. The motion has been made to move to executive session for the purpose of receiving legal advice. It has been seconded by Dr. Davey. Is there any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. All opposed, nay. Motion carries.
Hi, everyone. This is Miss Malice. I'm going to give you the next code word. And the next code word is North America. North America. Thank you.
It looks like we are all back in open session here. We will resume applicant number 13, which is Zachary Giertek. And I will say that in my review of the file, including the implications, education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declarations, I find it to be both administratively and substantively complete and would recommend that it moves forward to the full board for potential approval. Okay, we will move to application number 14, which is Sydney Esch. Dr. Byrie, you're the lead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in my review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declarations, I find it to be both administratively and substantively complete, and I recommend it goes to the board.
Excellent. We will move to application number 15, which is Kelsey Elliott. Dr. Rates, you're the lead on this application.
So for this application, I'll remind my fellow committee members, this was someone that we asked for a fair for some additional information, and the individual had a couple hundred hours that she was not able to get documented and made multiple attempts with a previous supervisor, as did the board. We also recognize that she was here and asked if she could provide some information related to supervision that she's received while here in Arizona and the nature of her role. We did get information from both her as well as a licensed BCBA here in the state related to the amount of supervision that's been provided and what her role has been since being here in the state of Arizona. Upon review of that, I believe that it meets our requirements and that we can move that forward. She has received well over the 200 hours that unfortunately the previous supervisor could not give her. And then the role that she is engaging in here is being directly overseen by this LBA. And so I think with that additional information, we can recommend that this move forward.
Thank you, Dr. Rates. We will move to another application of yours, Dr. Rates, which is Rochelle Finch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declaration, finds it to be both administratively and substantively complete. The only note that I would add is just that the individual did share that they are also licensed by the Department of Ed, and that license is in good standing. So with that, I would recommend we move this forward to the board.
Wonderful. Applicant number 17 is Carolina Elias. Dr. Byra, you are the lead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in my review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declarations, I found it to be both administratively and substantively complete, and I recommend it go to the board.
Wonderful. Application number 18 is Sophia Guerrero. Dr. Davey, you're the lead. You're muted, Dr. Davey.
It's great things to say. In my review of Ms. Guerra's application, including her education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and declaration, I find it to be both administratively and substantively complete.
We will move to application number 19, which is Faith Hendon. Dr. Stenhoff, you're the lead on this application.
Thank you. My review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and declarations, both to be administratively and substantively complete, and recommend it move forward to the board for approval.
Okay. Application number 21 is the next we will review, which is Danielle Russell. Dr. Byron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So for Ms. Russell, in my review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and declarations, I found it to be both administratively and substantively complete, and I recommend that it go to the board.
We will move to application number 22, which is Dolly Misner. Dr. Davey?
Yes, in reviewing Ms. Misner's application, including her education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declarations, I find it to be both administratively and substantively complete.
Thank you. Applicant number 23 is Jenna Jensen. Dr. Stenhoff?
My review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declarations, I found it both to be administratively and substantively complete, and recommend moving forward to the board.
We will move now to application number 25 with Jordan Gibson. Dr. Rates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declaration, find it to be both administratively and substantively complete. I will just note supervision did all occur in California, which does not have licensure. So again, it would meet all of our requirements, and I would recommend it move forward.
I'm going to circle back around to you again, Dr. Rates, with Karen Barrichello. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Madam Chair, my review of this file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and declaration, finds it to be both administratively and substantively complete. I will note that the applicant did indicate that they are also licensed as an LBA in Texas. I would recommend that we move this forward.
Wonderful. This completes all of the applicants for our typical pathway towards licensure. I can never remember this, so I apologize for asking once again. Do we need to make the motion before we look at universal recognition applications, or can I lump them together?
I would go ahead and take this group first.
Okay. All right. Is there a motion for?
I don't know if anyone has notes. I have notes. But...
Dr. Byra has notes. You're muted. You raised your hand, so maybe you don't have notes. But...
Sorry. No, I do. Well, I have one just because one of my applicants, we did say we wanted to issue that fare to get those additional supervision hours. So that was one of mine. Just want to make note of that.
Would board staff, anyone like to review the list of applications that need additional support?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will do a quick review. So we have number 2 and number 20. They both need subpoenas. We have number 3, which is Laura Vargas. She has a typo and then she can move forward. We then have number 8, and that is Sydney Cardiff. That is a fair. Everyone else is able to move forward with recommendation to the board.
So moved.
Ooh,
it was like choral responding. The motion has been made by me. It has been seconded by Dr. Rates. Is there any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, nay. The motion carries. We will go ahead and move down to agenda item number 8B, which is behavior analyst applications for licensure by universal recognition. The first applicant via this universal recognition pathway is Laura Assisi, perhaps. Dr. Davey, you're the lead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In reviewing the rules and regulations around universal recognition, as well as Mrs. Cece's application, I find the file to be complete, both administratively and substantively, and therefore would like to see it move forward for to the full board.
Fantastic. And to this applicant, I see you're on the line. If we butchered your name, I do apologize. I am sure that might have been a rough thing to hear. We'll move on to, did we say it right?
It's the CC. It's fine. Nobody gets it.
I got it. I got the
you
assist.
Got it. You did get it.
My Italian paid off for a moment.
That's right. It's the city in Italy. Like, yep.
That's
yep.
Right. That trip to Florence paid off. We'll have to take the full board there on a field trip.
Thank you.
Okay. We will move to applicant number 2 via universal recognition, Magdalena McNeely, Dr. Byron.
Thanks very much. I'm not sure if this applicant is on the call because I do see some phone numbers without names. Going through the regulations for universal recognition, she does meet all criterion. She's currently living in Arizona. She has been licensed in Texas since June 30th of 2022. I will just want to make a note for her that her BACB registry still has her location set to San Antonio, Texas. So my one recommendation would be for her to update that. But otherwise, looking at the review of the file from both a administrative and substantively complete, I do recommend she goes to the board. I would just request she make the updates to the registry.
These are all of the applications via the universal recognition pathway. Is there a motion to move these applications forward to the board?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Is there any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed, nay. The motion carries. We will now move to agenda item number 8C. Agenda item number 8C is requesting approval for telehealth registration via ARS 36-3606. The first applicant under this agenda item is Olivia Ramirez Roberts. Dr. Rates, you're the lead.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. In review of the requirements and this application, I find it to be complete and meet our requirements and would recommend that we move it forward.
The next application is Natalie Ramirez. Dr. Davey?
Yes, I reviewed Ms. Ramirez's application for the telehealth registry, ARS 36-3606, and administratively and substantively, the application is complete. Thank you.
Is there a motion to... We send these forward to the full board, correct? We don't see telehealth yes. applications very often.
So moved.
Second.
Okay. It has been motioned by Dr. Davey to move these applications to the full board for potential approval. It has been seconded by Dr. Stenhoff. Is there any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, nay. The motion carries. Okay, what I would like to do at this point is to ask for a code word. And after we get that code word, I would like to offer a comfort break to those on the call this morning. So, Ms. Malice, can you offer a code word before we disperse?
Madam Chair, I gave the third code word while you guys were in executive session. Oh. So we're good on that.
You're so sneaky. I had my watch set. It was giving me a buzz so I wouldn't forget. And you just got it done.
No, thank you. I set my alarm also.
Okay, great. Well, let's take a 10-minute break. Come back at 1 o'clock. Okay, see everyone soon.
The Department of Education is quite capable of using reinforcement procedures as part of their practice, and reinforcement procedures that could be considered behavior analytic in nature, differential reinforcement, DROs, DRAs. I mean, I'm not going to go on, but I just want to make sure we're not somehow inadvertently, to use the parlance of our time, stepping in it or putting our foot in our mouth, and that we are not sending up some signals to the Department of Ed that we're trying to restrict in any way behavior management programs or protocols that a variety of special education teachers in particular, not withholding the regular education teachers, may be using it as well, may employ in their daily classroom management situations. So I would just encourage us to perhaps include some sort of statement in there to clarify, who in fact we are targeting, or those that are holding themselves out as a behavior analyst, or perhaps who are currently holding national certification, or those that are calling themselves behavior specialists in schools where there is no certification for that. Like, I want to be cognizant of what educators, and by educators, I mean certified teachers, are engaged in.
Dr. Sinha?
Yeah, and I think to that too is there's somewhat of overlap, or could be overlap, and I guess we need to have that discussion too. So I'm a special ed teacher certified by the state. I'm also a VCBA. Do I need to be licensed, or does my certification account for that? Because of the nature of being a special ed teacher, you do FBAs, you do behavior management, you do BIPs, all of the above. Does my certification as my ADE certification as a teacher or licensure, I'm not sure which one it is here in the state, does that count? Can I be a BCBA and still practice under my special ed hat?
And maybe, Ms. Galvin, this is where we kind of lean on you a little bit for the interpretation of this. Is the interpretation that we have here that the Department of Education cannot certify a behavior analyst? And so as a result, the only situation in which you would have your ADE certification acting as that exemption, right, would be if you were practicing as a special education teacher, right? If you were, as Dr. Davey says, like employing behavior analytic strategies in your work as a special education teacher, how do we interpret that?
And I would need to look into that. I'm not prepared to, I have an idea, but I'm not prepared to offer that as legal advice at this time.
Chair.
Go for it, Dr. Stanhope.
Okay. So the other issue, and Brian or Dr. Davey brought this up as well. If I have I'm acting as a RBT, not RBT, excuse me, a paraprofessional, or some other paraprofessional type position, whatever term you want to put on it, and I'm a BCBA, but I'm hired as a paraprofessional, but employing behavior analytic techniques, do I need to be licensed if I'm a BCBA doing that stuff, even though I'm hired as a paraprofessional?
I mean, I would think that if you're a paraprofessional, you're not certified by the Arizona Department of Education. Right. And if you act in any sort of behavior analytic capacity, such as writing a behavior plan or engaging in an FBA or, recommending teachers that, try out this DRA procedure. I would envision that as unlicensed practice.
Now I'm going to propose this argument as well for the committee. The reality is that we all engage in behavior analytic practices 100% of the time if you have a pulse. And even more precisely, I mean, yes, you're doing it using behavioral terminology as a paraprofessional under the supervision of a licensed or licensed or certified, I'm not sure which one it is in the state, special ed teacher. But my engagement, wearing my paraprofessional hat as opposed to I'm not hired as a BCBA, Does that exclude me from needing to be licensed? And Madam Chair, you made the point that that you'd be practicing without a license. However, your job isn't that. And as I stated earlier, we really do engage in sometimes horribly designed behavior analytic practices unintentionally, just the fact that we're all operantly controlled. And if I've babysat, I have some idea on how to get a kid to bed usually. Toilet training in school setting, using a token economy in a school setting, all of that above. I might have a greater extensive knowledge, but do I need to be licensed if that is not my job description or not description? Excuse me. It would be my job description, but it would not be my job title or purpose of hire.
Yeah. I'll go after you, Dr. Byron.
I mean, I think you raised a good point, Dr. Stenhoff, but I guess my thought is like, you can't unlearn what you know, right? So like, even if I'm hired even if I'm a school volunteer, right? I'm coming in just to help in my kid's classroom because there's a really high or really low, teacher to student ratio. So I'm going to come, help in the afternoon and help run reading centers. I'm not a reading specialist, but as a behavior analyst, I can probably figure out how to break things down into a task analysis and those kind of things, right? Like, am I acting as a behavior analyst in that role? Like, I wasn't hired to do that. I'm not even getting paid in volunteering, right? But I'm not really sure how you turn off that part of your brain. So for a paraprofessional, yes, like you wouldn't normally ask a paraprofessional to write a behavior plan, right? But I also, hope cheaper. That head tilt makes me cringe. But in theory, they're just hopefully following and carrying out a behavior plan that someone else has written and they're being supervised, right? Ideally, as a paraprofessional. If I would happen to go be a paraprofessional right now, I think it'd be difficult to not say, hey, I see some problems with this and want to make some tweaks or make recommendations to make some tweaks because of my background and training. Now, to go back to the special education piece, if I'm a certified special ed teacher, right? There's plenty of special ed teachers who are not BCBAs who are still put in the role to do behavior plans and FBAs and those kind of things. So I guess I would ask, could you do that role without behavior analytic, training, right? Like, could you do that without a certification like we have? Like, I guess they're in those positions and they're doing it. I just think that's impossible to unlearn what you know, right? Like that your intellectual property in your brain, like you can't just hang it up for the day and say like, I'm just going to be a special ed teacher today. I'm not going to be a behavior analyst and I'm only going to use the tools that I learned in that program. Like, I don't know how you would possibly differentiate that and not have the influence your decision-making skills because you can't unknow the things you've been trained as a behavior analyst, even if you're quote acting as a special ed teacher. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think what I would say in response to what Dr. Stenhoff was saying and you, Dr. Byra, is, where my thought process is going here is it's not just a title act that we have, it's a title and practice act. And I'm not sure where we determine the practice. Like, it seems to be getting a little bit blurry here as far as what special education teachers can do and what behavior analysts can do and all of this. So that's just kind of where I'm thinking here is like, if you were a paraprofessional and you were hired as a paraprofessional, right, it's, well, the title isn't a problem, right? It might be the practice, so anyway, Dr. Stenhoff, I think you were next. You raised your hand and then you lowered it and now you're back up.
I did this funky thing where I brought my hand down without me even doing anything. So that was interesting. I'm happy to let Dr. Davey go. And then
Dr.
Davey. Oh, your kindness is thank you for it. I think the piece that I guess I pulled up the exemptions, right? Number one reads a behavior analyst who is employed. Doesn't say a person. It doesn't say, this, that, or the other. It is clearly going after like a BCBA, for lack of a better term, who's employed by a common school. So it's like, it's essentially, if I'm looking at that language, my interpreter would be, if you are certified by the national certifying body, then you are, this is, that exemption is talking to you. It's not, if you look at the other exemptions, it's like an employee of, a graduate student, a person. Number one clearly starts off a behavior analyst who is employed in a common school. And so I think that language there also, with Ms. Galvin's putting her legal brain around this, that those kinds of distinctions of what's in there and like where that's, you know, what the intent was when this exemption was crafted, you know, way back in the day, it feels like that was 20 years ago. I think that that's important to take a look at that piece that is speaking to that who's certified. And it goes back to that point of like, if you hold the certification as well as, you know, BCBA certification, as well as you're a special education teacher, you know, that may be of who they were trying to get to at that particular point. I don't have the greatest recollection of all of those conversations from back in the day, but I believe it was to make sure that we were protecting the limited number of practices that were going on in the schools with behavior analysts at that point. But I do think that it's interesting, if you look at that, how we've labeled, you know, the qualifier for each one of the six exemptions, you know, it has that kind of description of who we're talking about, whether it's a non-credentialed individual. You know, number six covers, I believe, some of the things we were talking about, a non-credentialed individual who delivers applied behavior analysis services under the extended authority and direction of a licensed behavior analyst, right? So that's protecting our RBTs. The individual may not claim to be, you know, professional behavior analyst. Like, we don't have that kind of language for the extension of someone in the school, like the, you know, the paraprofessional, Dr. Stenhoff, that you were talking about. And so we, you know, as we kind of look at, well, the landscape has changed in terms of just number of services available by behavior analysts across the state in the last 15 years. You know, it has changed exponentially. I mean, at one point, you know, there's what, 50 of us around. Now the numbers are looking like 1,000 licensed, 1,500 certified in the state, somewhere in there. You know, it is probably good for us to, you know, make a strong statement here, have a very clear articulation of what it is we are expecting by the many, not, you know, the many people that this could impact, not just the professionals that we're speaking to, but this will have impact per, you know, if we don't do it well, it's going to impact services and access to care. So I think we just need to be cognizant of that as we move forward.
Dr. Stenhall.
Yeah, just of note, I mean, Dr. Davey, your point is of a behavior analyst. It does list that specifically, but it's a compound exemption. There's two parts to it. Yes, a behavior analyst, and then you look at later on in the next clause, and who is certified by that. And so it's setting up, yes, you're a behavior analyst who is certified in this statute that is not, that obviously is has been misinterpreted, but there's two pieces to it that they're certified, which is where this statute falls apart. We have the one person or the person who's a behavior analyst, but also had to be certified, which doesn't exist in the state. So the statute had to have two components to it, a behavior analyst and is certified, which is not the, which is in the problem. So I'm just, the concern I have is that then-ness or that overlap of stating that, well, if you're a behavior analyst, you have to be licensed. Well, if you're already certified, do you have to be? And then if you're not certified or are certified, then you're exempt as a behavior analyst, even though you still have your behavior analyst blood running through you. You know, Dr. Byra made the point too, is like, if you're stepping in as a classroom volunteer, that you can't necessarily take off that behavior analyst hat. But, you know, so I think there just needs to be clarity about where that line is drawn of what it is. And that was the, you know, because it required two pieces of it and one piece fell apart in the statute, it, you know, that it causes a total a breakdown of the statute with that piece of it. And so I think we, if it is a committee or I don't know, the board or whoever this is, happens to be, that it has to be clarified. And I just, you know, stepping outside the school, but if I'm a licensed counselor, and I use ACT in my counseling practice, from my behavior analyst side, do I need to be licensed if I'm practicing as a licensed counselor and using an effective, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, if you want to say it that way? Does that mean that I have to be licensed if my full position now is a licensed clinical psychologist or licensed clinical counselor, something along those lines? And so there's going to be these gray overlap areas, but I think they have to be clearly delineated. Otherwise, we're going to be back in the same problem where, oh, if you're this, you don't have to be that, or, you know, those kinds of things. And so I think it's just proceeding with caution and with clarity would hopefully minimize something like this from happening in the future.
I do think there is a teensy bit of clarity that comes in that exemption wording where it says, and who is certified to use that title by the Department of Education if the services or activities are part of the duties of that person's common school, high school, or charter school employment. You know, so, you know, is this the common practice of what a counselor would do? Is this the common practice of what a school psychologist would do? Is this the common practice of what a general education teacher or a special education teacher would do? You know, and like you're talking about, Dr. Stenhoff, like, yeah, teachers use behavior analytic principles all the time, right? And they likely don't even know their behavior analytic principles in some situations, you know, or you might even have like a counselor who doesn't, who isn't as aware as maybe we might be about the roots of ACT and where it came from and the behavior analytic conceptual underpinnings of that therapeutic modality. So I definitely agree that there needs to be some clarification there, but I do think there's a little bit that comes from the wording where it talks about is part of that person's duties. Dr. Byra?
I'm also thinking about, you know, just from a supervision standpoint, right? Oftentimes in schools, like there's also multidisciplinary clinicians, right? Like you may have an SLP who also has their BCBA, right? Like, isn't that lovely when you can find folks that have both? Like, but what are you operating under? Are you an SLP? Are you a BCBA? Like, are you going to decide on Monday doing SLP stuff and then on Tuesday you're doing BCBA stuff? And if you have a practicum student there, I think it just needs to be really clear to the public, you can't get your supervision in the public school setting unless your supervisor is licensed, even if they're allowed to work there because they have a title of special education teacher or a regular teacher or a school counselor or SLP or OT, PT, whatever the case may be, just making it very clear just because they're allowed to work without the license because of their other certification, that your hours are not going to count with them towards your certification.
I think it also comes into kind of something that we ran into with an applicant last meeting on March 1st. There was an applicant who had been supervised, and I think they're actually still on the line right now, but they had been supervised by a psychologist. And a psychologist was licensed as a psychologist, right? And why don't those hours count, you know? And if we see this as a situation where, oh, well, yes, the psychologist who was in the school was licensed as a psychologist, and the BACB might say that person can provide some level of supervision, right? Because of their experience and their training and going through this. But you know, that would come back to, you know, those psychologists and physical therapists and counselors and, you know, these other OTs, right? Individuals who may be licensed in other capacities. But, you know, it comes down to like that license is not the same as a behavior analyst license. So I think that kind of ties in here. And I think this conversation is going to have roots that touch a variety of other pieces. And I'm not sure, Ms. Pakkinen, what is going to come from this conversation today. I think we've opened a can of worms, and we'll need to flesh this out more as we go through. So, you know, I'm not trying to make everyone end their conversation of this, but perhaps what it is we continue this conversation. Perhaps we take it to the full board and ask for that conversation there. You know, psychologists have been practicing much longer than behavior analysts in the state of Arizona, have navigated these waters. Perhaps they would have some input here. Ms. Pakkinen?
Madam Chair, I definitely don't think that's a terrible idea, but I think that what I'm observing is this is one of those instances where, you know, I am certain the board would look to the subject matter experts, the committee, you know, to really inform the board. I don't think that, you know, with the exception of the board chair, who was, you know, as part of this very recent assembly of governance leadership, I really don't think this issue is terribly understood, and the board would defer to an extensive degree to the committee, you know, to bring forward a very informed discussion about this. I do think that you are making some excellent points relative to, you know, this. We can't make any recommendations right away. And I was under no such illusion. And if I suggested that, you know, we need to hurry and get, you know, something to the board and act upon a plan, I certainly didn't mean to do that. You know, there's other strategies that the committee can use. I think, you know, just putting this on a future meeting agenda, continuing the conversation, you know, inviting maybe some specific subject matter experts, you know, to provide some input to help inform the committee. That's always an option. You know, it just allowing stakeholders, you know, more opportunity to give input. I don't know that. And maybe I'm wrong, but I'm not sure that anyone from the Department of Education, maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't, you know, help inform the discussion. But I'm suggesting that, you know, the board is going to say, well, this is a really interesting and challenging topic. Committee, we need you to inform us with, you know, a well-informed and, you know, a supported set of recommendations to move forward. So I think this issue is, you know, it needs to continue to happen at this level, but with informed expertise to help you.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Reitz?
Yeah, I just wonder if it's worth the effort to also look into other state licensures and see how they're addressing issues of behavior analysts in school settings. I'm not aware of that, but it might be something that we should look into to see if there's any guidance there that can help drive our decision making.
I think that's a valid point. I like that idea. We'll kind of get into here in a future agenda item where we recently went to the BACB's regulators event. We had board staff there, and Dr. Davey and I were both there, and, you know, we made some connections with people, and, you know, perhaps that information would not be difficult to ascertain.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we can put that question, ask that the question be posed on the regulators' listserv to please you know, copy paste, just simply your language, if any, that exempts, that represents the kind of exemption that maybe we thought this language represented. So that being said, I think Dr. Rates, it's an excellent suggestion. We don't know entirely how other states may or may not certify, you know, register, regulate, you know, in education settings. So that would need to be part of the question.
So I presume we need to determine if a motion is necessary. Can we direct board staff to gather additional information from the regulators' listserv to get some knowledge of how other states and departments of education and licensing boards are handling this particular area of practice, I guess, and licensure? Is that something that needs a motion? Can we just request that and bring it back to a future agenda?
This is Jean Galvin. I think the committee should decide first what route it's going to take. Are you going to follow the procedure sort of outlined in Heidi's memo and make a recommendation to the board, or do you want more information first? Do you want more information from other states before you make that recommendation to the board?
I think I personally would like some additional information before we send something forward to the full board. And I certainly don't want to send something forward that creates another potential future, like, oh, we didn't think about that, and we haven't clarified appropriately what that exemption would look like, and what it wouldn't look like, and who would need to go through this. Because I think if we move it forward to the full board as described at this point, with the questions that we have, right, the questions that the committee members, who are more likely well-versed with Arizona exemptions and rules and statutes, you know, I can only imagine that if we don't have this clarified, it will cause a bit of panic in our community amongst those BCBAs who are in schools. Anybody else agree with that or want to add?
I would agree. I would like to get some more information before we move anything forward to the board.
I would agree as well, but I do think once we have that information, what's outlined by Ms. Packanen is the correct path.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Davey, I'm sorry I missed you. Could you say that one more time?
I was just saying that I agree we need a little bit more information, but then once we have that information, I believe we should follow the path that's outlined in the memo from Ms. Beckman.
Yes.
Agreed.
I would recommend at least that there be an information item on the board agenda. So in the event that this issue becomes, you know, more aware and alive out there, that the board is not blindsided, and at least let the board know that it's before the committee, we're researching it, we're getting ready to make a recommendation.
Mm-hmm. And I had one other stakeholder that maybe when we're reaching out, like I agree the regulatory bodies will be helpful and see what kind of languages they have an exemption. But do we also need to get with ADE and see as a, you know, as a stakeholder in this, like this was obviously, you know, back in the day, this was put in for a reason and would not want to get us to the point of where we're getting ready to release this, and then we have a state agency who's unhappy with us making such a move. Do we at least want to get them in the know, Ms. Packanen, with maybe a courtesy FYI that we're looking at this language, and if they have any input, to please step forward?
Yes, Madam Chair, Dr. Davey. So I think in order, the way I'm seeing this is that Sure, I can do some more, and we'll do some more fact gathering, of course. But I think that in presenting those facts on a future meeting agenda, and I did inform the committee members about the next series of committee meetings and how really there are in the immediate future, those meetings, just by virtue of different circumstances, are really not conducive to, you know, continuing this discussion. So that's going to be a little frustrating that, you know, we're going to have to hit the pause button, and it will be a few months before we can resume this conversation. But that being said, that allows us to gather more facts. I think concurrently with the review of those facts, what I would like to see is that the agenda item also bring in the opportunity for stakeholder input, testimony, you know, whatever you want to call it, so that we aren't doing one, we aren't presenting more information that we've gathered on one agenda. And then, you know, we kick it to the next agenda before we bring in, you know, more experts to inform us. So what I'm saying is, you know, give me direction for how you want to try to bring all of this together, the next opportunity that we have, and knowing that we have a possible set of procedural steps to move forward, that we are simply putting on hold until we're better informed. Does that all make sense?
So outlining what I think we're saying is that we need to place an agenda item on the board's agenda for informing them of the conversations that are happening and, you know, making them aware of the future consideration that will be occurring surrounding some of the potential actions that may be taken. And so that would be one piece, right? And then the other piece would be that we have a future agenda item for the committee following an information gathering journey from board staff for the BACB's listserv for other regulators in other states, as well as gathering information potentially from the Arizona Department of Education surrounding the fact that we are looking into this exemption from licensure and the wording of it, and that we would like their input, as Dr. Davey was mentioning, if they have any implications, as well as when we get that agenda item on the future CBA meeting, that we would have stakeholders be invited to the meeting for the discussion of that agenda item. Did I summarize everything appropriately? Did I leave anything out, fellow committee members? Is this a motion? Okay, great. Okay. Is there any further discussion on this before we move to the next agenda item? Okay. Ms. Malice, should we have a code word? I stopped setting my alarm, but you offered it when we weren't here, so I don't know what time it was.
It is time for a code word. The next code word, Madam Chair, is 4 minutes. 4 minutes. Thank you.
So we will move on to agenda item number 10, which is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding application processing procedures when content deficiencies and errors are identified in both the administrative review timeframe and the substantive review timeframe. I would like to hear something from Ms. Malice and Ms. Pakenham regarding this matter. If you can provide a summary for the committee, I don't know who would be best to go first. So I'm going to let the two of you duke it out and decide who's going to present first.
Madam Chair, we didn't actually coordinate this necessarily, but I'm going to suggest that I provide a high-level overview. And then Ms. Malice is really the subject matter expert as it relates to, this is her list that she brainstormed. The list is not short. And so I think that this content is useful in a number of ways, and we can sort of get to that. But really, you know, we've had a lot of conversation around this issue of, you know, we see really two categories, broad categories of errors, if you will, that that prevent an application from being approved, both at this level and then, you know, in many cases, or at least in some of the cases, moving forward to the board, you know, 7 days later for approval. So I asked Z produce a list, and she delivered this one. And so what I think, I'm not suggesting we do this today. I think that there are some different strategies we can use, but I think that we would benefit from having some clarity around, you know, categorizing these, if you will, for consistency purposes, that, you know, which ones are we going to treat, you know, in a formal sense with the first additional information request or FAIR, and then which of these can we just simply address through a more informal mechanism. It isn't to say that the informal mechanism has been useful. It has enabled many applications to go to the board because of, you know, they are really not super substantive in nature. They wouldn't be, or else you wouldn't feel comfortable with, you know, just sort of those typographical errors or those simple omissions of information being corrected and verified by staff, right? So we could complete that column in a few ways. We could have all the committee members, you know, as use this as your homework assignment, and you come back to a future meeting and we see if anyone arrives at sort of the same answers or different answers. You could have Ms. Malice bring, you know, some recommended answers to you and categories, which that's so far, that's my favorite idea, but she's not speaking up right now to defend herself, but that's what I recommend. And then of course the committee could do something differently. And then this list could be published, you know, too, for purposes of, hey, applicants, these are, you know, Dr. Davey often calls these, many of these, unforced errors, where these are instances where your application may not be approved because, you know, this is something, this is a detail that eluded you or whatever the case may be. And if you didn't respond, you know, promptly enough to a request to correct them, well, that delays action on your application. So this could be an education and awareness tool. But really, I think this, in a different sense, this question or this issue, Madam Chair, you had requested this come before the committee. We need to talk about what happens in either instance when we have someone who doesn't respond to a FAIR, which is rare, but even when someone doesn't respond to a simple email, a simple request sent by Ms. Malice, please correct this date. It's clearly the wrong date, or, you know, please, you know, whatever, fix this typographical error. Astonishingly, we have applicants who don't follow through and complete that. And so their applications are stalled. So what I think we need to talk about is the timeframes rule R426-417. And I've linked it for you. What subsection D states is that whenever there is a deficiency identified in the substantive review timeframe, which is this, it is the committee reviewing the substance of an application, then the applicant has 240 days to fix, remedy, cure that issue. The way I read the rule, it doesn't matter how we've notified them. It could be with a FAIR. It could be with an email from Zakiya. So if they simply don't respond within 240 days, the application is closed, end of story. If they want a license, they have to reapply. So I think if there's agreement about that, that's, you know, we've made some progress. And what Z can do is she can also articulate that not only in the FAIR letters, but also, you know, when she sends an email requesting a correction, look, you should be able to give me a correction in, you know, in 45 seconds. But if you don't and you don't respond for 240 days, your application is closed. So I think that I'm not necessarily looking for this to be an action item, but I'd love some direction about, you know, sort of what I'm suggesting and what I'm recommending. And I will say that, you know, I've talked about a bill that so far it's going to reach Governor Hobbs. And what it will do is it will really call into question which of these are administrative issues, which are substantive issues. It's going to compel us, I think, if the bill is signed, to declare where do these fall in the administrative decision-making camp or the substantive decision-making camp. And, you know, we need to be prepared to defend how we represent that. And we will potentially have to significantly modify what we do. It may be that all of these, every single one of these errors is something that we can't as staff request corrections for before you ever see the applications. It may be that any of these individually or in combination have to be identified during the substantive review time and corrected in the substantive review timeframe, that 240 days. So this is kind of a big discussion, but for purposes of today, I think we want the awareness of, you know, regardless of how it is that we communicate out an application problem, the applicant has 240 days to fix it. You know, how we treat this, you know, going forward, we're just going to have to be prepared to make some decisions.
Dr. Davey?
Yeah, so Ms. Pacman, do you remember when I forget what drove us in this direction, but we started looking at other boards' approaches to, let's just call them administrative violations, right? Like the failure to renew. I think we found that some boards saw that as just like an administrative penalty, you know, a $50 fine, and then they could reapply. Or that, you know, they had put in some sort of like remedies that didn't necessarily move that level of a concern over to a full board decision. So are there some, so my point to that background is, are there some boards that are established and respected and have a process of excellence that would kind of delineate what are those that are administrative that we could maybe look at versus those that are substantive? Could you also bring us maybe an example to look at?
Madam Chair, Dr. Davey, I'd love to hear what Ms. Galvin has to say. She engages with more boards than I do on a, you know, daily, weekly, monthly basis. I have thoughts, but I think hers are probably better informed and deeper and wider than mine.
Ms. Galvin.
I just don't know if my level of contact with the boards allows me to kind of form an opinion about that as far as their processes. A lot of my boards, the staff approve the applications. And unless there's an issue, the applications just go through staff and they're approved. So they don't come to the board and have this review and determine what is missing and how we ask for it. So
I'm just going to say wow out loud.
you, if I, I'm off the top of my head, I'm thinking that you are the only board that I'm familiar with where the committees actually review all of the applications. So I'm not aware of the behind the scenes, what goes on when we need additional information from with other boards.
Ms. Pakenham, are you about to propose that maybe we just change everything?
Madam Chair, I so am not. So my experience really is informed only by one other board. So that board's application requirements were incredibly simple. I speak very wistfully and longingly for the past that I once knew, which is the clinical training aspect of the preparation for licensure with that other profession was folded into the degree program. And the degree program was not a degree program unless it was accredited by a single accreditor. So you can imagine how simple, how blissfully simple and beautiful that world really was. So when an application was submitted and the application reflected that the individual graduated from Northern Arizona University with a doctorate of physical therapy, it was abundantly clear, didn't require any verification, that this was an accredited program, it met the requirements, and the clinical training, all of that piece, by virtue of it being a component of successfully completing that degree, that means the staff had nothing to do in terms of verifying this. So if you look at Zakiya's list, you will see that so much of this list, so many of the errors that we could categorize as either substantive or administrative, they do relate to the supervised training experience. So, you know, that to me, that is quicksand for staff to ever sort of try to tread out into. And so I am extremely uncomfortable at the suggestion that, we take any of that review and verification process over. I don't think you could convince me otherwise. I just wouldn't want to do that. Now, curiously, Ms. Galvin's not wrong. Since I left PT, that board has elected that because the verification, process, because the requirements are so very simple in that beautiful world, the staff is easily able to do the administrative and the substantive review. But I think what they do is they have the board ratify applications, after board staff has approved them. I never would have agreed to do that if I had stayed with that board. I'm surprised and I cannot endorse that. So that's how I feel. Of course, if this board were to shift in a drastically different direction, I'd have to figure out, how do we pivot and, not put the public at risk in the process. And again, I think this bill, House Bill 2100, I think what it signals is that the legislature is telling the administrative staff, you are not to make substantive decisions about applications. So as far as I'm concerned, we can comply with that. We'd have to make some modifications to what we do, but not in the dramatic sense that say that, maybe the PT board would have to. Maybe they'd have to sort of, pivot back to the old school way where it's just too risky for administrative staff to say, well, we did the administrative review. Now we've done the substantive review. This person is good to have a license and board, just ratify it after the fact. Or board, you'll only see the problematic applications. I really see that bill, if it's enacted, sort of, you know, maybe pulling back away from that, back to the 1990s and 2000s, if you will. So did I answer the question, or did I just sort of go on a little bit of a rant? I'm not sure that I did.
I don't remember the question, to be honest.
I don't either.
Dr. Byra has her hand raised, though.
You did answer the question. It was about whether or not we had some other points of reference, and Ms. Galvin helped answer the question as well, as like what we're seeing out there, what we actually can do, what we should be doing. So yes, thank you.
Dr. Byron?
So I know not every problem can be solved with technology, but I do, like, I've brought this up before, and like doing the reviews for the first time for this meeting, like there's definitely things that came up where I'm like, oh, well, here's an issue. How do we solve this? And it's like, oh, we have to wait, or we have to ask for the FAIRP, like in the open meeting, where I do think there's ways for us to get the software to ask folks additional questions. So if they're not able to come to the meeting, right, if it gets prompted to, like with the DUI, Dr. Davey, right, like, tell us more about this, right? Like, if he wasn't able to come today, which I'm really glad that he was, but if he wasn't, you know, if your question to him would be, and if the question would always be, and I guess too, some of this speaks to, I think we want to try and be as standardized in approaches to like all applicants. So if the candidate that I had was 28 hours short, like if it really is the case, like, can you provide documentation for those 28 hours past your certification? Like, is that always going to be the way we request it? And Dr. Davey, if there's always a, you know, misdemeanor charge or whatever the case that they answered yes, is our question always going to be, what did you learn from this, or explain how this has impacted your life, or whatever the case may be? Why can we not prompt the system to ask that question, get that candidate to respond? So in the case they can't come, because I guess I'm not really sure, like, what would have happened today if that candidate wasn't on the call? Would we have asked for them to come another time? What if we would have just all said, well, it was 8 years ago and there's no other, you know, spots on their record, I guess we're cool. Like, I feel like for transparency for the public, like, if this happens, this is how we will typically respond. I think the way to standardize that is through the application process. So if you are less than 1500 hours, here's what we want you to submit for documentation. And on multiple meetings when we've asked for fares, I feel like that question comes up a lot, and we say, well, you'll get the information in the fare. Like, well, what is it actually going to say? Because if I'm an applicant and I'm coming to these calls, like, why can't I preemptively be prepared that this is exactly what I need to get? Because, hey, I still work at the place I got my supervision, my supervisor's down the hall, like, let me just go get that right now. Like, I just think the better we can be standardized in that approach, the better. And if we can get some of this stuff sorted before they come to the meeting, I'm just thinking of the, what was it, 91 days, 98 days, whatever that average time from application to getting it approved, like, how can we reduce that latency? I think everyone would be happier. I, as a reviewer, would be feeling much better that we're getting folks licensed much quicker, especially when we don't want them to be, we've had issues with, and difference of opinions of the mid-tier billing, right? Like, you can't bill because you're not really a candidate anymore. It's like, well, true, I just passed my test, but now I'm waiting to be licensed and it's taking forever. If we have these systemic problems, like, how do we not band-aid it, but how can we, from a proactive measure, how can we solve some of this? And I do think some of that solve comes from the software and making informed decisions without having to ask someone to come to this call and then wait. Because again, oh yes, 28 hours, I mean, deeper, she can cover that next week. I'm like, hey, can you supervise me for the next couple of weeks here, and I can get that need met? But she also probably could have done that had, when she done her application and it said, did all of your supervision happen in that state with a licensed supervisor from that state? If no, okay, here's your action item. That's the whole point of when you're doing decision modeling through an application, like, that's what it should lead the user to do. So then I could have had that data, been like, cool, she's gotten, you know, that 1,000 hours since that time, like, you know, sorted and verified. So she's good to go, as opposed to now a delay for a very little amount of time. I'm looking through these questions and, you know, not all of that can be solved. I get it. There are some things where I don't know how you would, you know, set the programming, but I do think there are so many options in software right now. And again, I speak because I build these. There are a lot of ways that you could have the system do these double checks. It should relief, it should push a relief valve for the staff as well, that the system's going to automatically check. So Z's not looking at, well, do all the dates look the same? Are all the numbers the same? Like, the system can check that. And it's just a matter of computer programming. That's not terribly difficult. And then it's going to alert the user right then and there. Are you sure you meant to check that box? Because it doesn't add up to the box you added earlier. And then they can fix it. And it won't be these 17 emails going back and forth that Z has to send out. But I will stop soapboxing now. Apparently it's soapbox hour of the day.
This is your chance. I would just comment that, you know, as you mentioned, the standardizing some of the processes, you know, one of the things that we, if you are in your declarations answering yes to something, you know, at that point, it probably should prompt it. Like, I think at this point, we make the comment of like, you're strongly encouraged to attend the meeting because there's most likely going to be questions. You know, it probably should trigger a congratulations, you're going to get to attend the meeting, versus us nicely reminding them that that's the case. And, you know, as kind of a historical point, like, we typically do want to hear, like, even if it was 7 years ago, like, we want to hear, like, as our charge around protecting our licensees and our public is, like, I want to hear that, you know, you can, it's easy to type up something. It's another thing to come and talk to us. Like, yeah, come tell us what's going on with that particular situation. We've had multiple people with multiple different felonies or misdemeanors, or, you know, that they were in their past, and we fully appreciate that. But I think that's part of our job, is to have that quick conversation and move on. And if it's not a and move on, then it's a, you know, we need additional information before we move this forward. So I do appreciate the idea of, like, hey, if you're going to check yes to this, that it's an automatic invite to when you're bored, when we have the meeting.
Ms. Pakkinen?
So as I think this through, I think that I don't think we need to move on this immediately, but I do think that in the coming weeks, months, we should probably identify, we should probably categorize these, you know, the way that I'm suggesting, which is, you know, is this formal? Because if it's formal, then there's a potential that by its very definition, that formal process, what may precipitate from that decision, from that action, that may lead to a denial of the application. So there are, in the majority of instances, it doesn't, you know, great, it was, you know, addressed, whether we're talking about they need 62 more hours, or, you know, they, you know, whatever it is. But the issuing a FAIR means this puts this application on potentially a path for denial. So that's not software, it's not conducive to a software-driven solution necessarily. But sure, I agree with Dr. Byra. There are plenty of instances here where, you know, we can take a critical look at those, you know, simple kinds of things that could be corrected. And we can make the system smarter to ask, you know, better questions to arrive at better information. So once we categorize them, let's see what the software can do, you know, in a solution sense, for the lower hanging fruit, if you will, right? The easy corrections. Still looming over our heads, though, is this legislation and the outcome of it. So in my mind, we really can't make a whole lot of progress forward in any sense until we have that clarity. So I think we just sort of need to see how House Bill 2100 plays out and then take it from there. And, you know, I think that you won't see me at the April committee meeting, or you won't see me at the May committee meeting. By June, I will know, of course, you know, what we need, whether we're going to have to pivot and how. So I think we just sort of have to keep, you know, moving forward in the best way that we can with this awareness. What we've established today is no matter how we tell you, you have a problem with your application, you need to fix it in 240 days. So we've accomplished that much. Everything else, I think we have more or less outlined a strategy to move forward with some reforms, but we still need, you know, some, we need to understand how some things play out over which we have no control.
Makes sense. So at the end of the 240-day period, their application would just be closed. And then they would need to reapply, pay the additional fee again, and go through from start to finish.
Yes, I do think that there are instances where someone initiates the application process and then decides to abandon it. And, you know, that happens sometimes early in the process, sometimes quite late in the process. And we don't often have the benefit of knowing that. Applicants curiously, and I saw this at PT too, even after paying several hundred dollars and waiting, you know, some days, weeks, months, you know, completing, at least partially completing the file, they walk away from it. You know, they take a different job or, you know, whatever. And so it's not all that uncommon for an application just to sort of languish. And then, you know, we track it and we realize, okay, the clock ran out, it's closed. So it's not, there aren't any consequences to that. It in a perfect world, the applicant tells us, I no longer wish to pursue this license, and they ask for it to be closed and we can document that. I would say that happens, you know, only a tiny fraction of the time. Too often, and it's not uncommon for, you know, someone to say, never mind, just to themselves, not to us.
Do we need to make a motion on anything? Are we good to move to the next agenda item?
I don't think so. Do you want Zakiya to go ahead and make some suggestions relative to how she would categorize these different errors in terms of, you know, staff verified, staff pursued corrections versus fares, and then you can take a look at that at a later date? And she and I can work together on that.
May be futile until the bill is, see if the bill passes. Might be an exercise.
Yeah, I see the point in that too. So we can just put that on pause. So mm-hmm. This conversation will come back to you in some format, you know, better informed, I'm sure, in a few months.
Thanks. We will go ahead and move on to agenda item number 11. Agenda item number 11 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding the report on the March 7th, 2024 Behavior Analyst Regulators meeting. This agenda item is for Dr. Davey and myself. Kind of figured the way that we could do this is, Dr. Davey, I'll provide a little bit of a summary and you could report on what you and Hyde talked about at the regulators meeting, perhaps?
Maybe.
Okay. We'll see how it goes here. So for those who are on, just an update, board staff, including Ms. Pakanon and Ms. Michelson, as well as committee members, Dr. Davey and myself, traveled to New Orleans to attend the Behavior Analyst Regulators meeting. Meeting, staff from the BACB hosted the regulators meeting in New Orleans, and they prepared some really valuable content. Representatives from other licensing boards were present from across the United States and participated in the event. With this being said, the BACB shared their role in regulating the practice of behavior analysis and differentiated it from the role of state licensing boards. And, you know, the BACB, you know, reiterated they're not an investigative body, whereas state licensing boards often do possess this authority. The board staff and committee members gathered insight from the practices of other boards and other states and contributed to solutions for commonly encountered challenges in regulation. Ms. Pakkinen and Dr. Davey represented Arizona so well. They shared information with in a presentation to all of the regulators and the BACB about Arizona's RAMP and JET program. And I think I can say that other states were impressed about the progressive actions that have been taken by Arizona's regulatory body. So that was pretty cool. Dr. Davey, over to you.
Yeah, I think you pretty much nailed it. It was a great event. I would just echo your statement that the work that this board has done, its current members, its past members, Ms. Pakkinen, was on full display. We were invited to, join at the podium to answer, a series of yes-no questions about how we handle things. Arizona was really highlighted as a well-established, well-working, high-functioning regulatory body, and that is to the credit of many on this call and some that have moved on. Dr. Davis Wilson, I see you're on the call, and so a credit to her as well, and anyone who served on this committee. And it was overall refreshing. There's a wide variety of agencies that were represented there, everywhere from states such as ourselves and Nevada that have been in this position for quite some time to brand new states such as Georgia that, are just starting to scratch the surface of what this is going to look like for their constituents. So overall, it was a great success. I want to thank the BACB for putting it on, APBA for providing the venue to make this happen. And hopefully we're going to see this this gathering continue in one way or another, either at future APBA meetings or at standalone meetings. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I guess we could open it up. Are there any questions from committee members about the regulators event? Okay.
Madam Chair, if I'm just sort of offer just a little update, I guess. This week I had two conversations with two of my counterparts, one from Minnesota and one from Ontario. The one from Minnesota anticipating that the language may pass in their state to require licensure of behavior analysts. Although when we were talking, he was literally getting text messages about, some negotiations that may be breaking down. So I really don't know what the fate was. But anyway, we'd scheduled this conversation in anticipation. The bill had been moving forward in earnest at that point. And then Ontario, it may be the first Canadian province to regulate behavior analysts, and they will begin in July. So I put my counterpart on notice for everything to prepare for in the coming months. And he's actually asked if we might meet with their team, their investigative team, to help them just orient them to the kinds of cases that, we've investigated, what we've learned from our investigations and so forth. So I said, why, yes. And I know who I would try to implicate in that kind of a training program. So we'll be having some more conversations around that.
Well, I think that kind of leads into agenda item number 12, which is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recent updates from the Behavior Analyst Certification Board. We're kind of right all in that space here. So Heidi, would you summarize any updates that we may have from the Behavior Analyst Certification Board?
Well, Madam Chair, we have none. I certainly would have if we had received some. My hunch is that, you know, they're all sort of recovering from, you know, what was, I'm sure, a lot of effort to put to develop it and execute that program. So I don't have anything to share at this time, but they did send a feedback survey to the participants of the regulator training event. So hopefully we will get some information about that. And as Dr. Davies said, maybe some clarity, you know, in terms of what to expect in the future, future opportunities for regulators to come together and learn from each other and engage.
Agenda item number 13 is discussion, consideration, and possible action on application in accordance with the application fee credit card dispute submitted by Ashley Fiorelli. Ms. Packman, you're the lead on this. Would you provide a summary of this matter for the committee?
I will, Madam Chair. Please, if you'll indulge me a moment, I accidentally closed my folder, so I'm navigating back to it. So this matter came to my awareness, and just by way of explanation, the when I am notified by our credit card company that someone has levied a charge dispute, I often receive it. I receive it by U.S. mail. I receive it, you know, very, very close to the response deadline. And it's a very cryptic document. If you did a review of the enclosure, maybe you saw what, you know, what I struggle with, which is, you know, it isn't immediately clear, you know, who's the card owner, you know, how I have to do some forensic work to sort of, you know, trace this all back to figure out who paid it and when. I mean, it was really clear to me from the amount that, you know, we were looking at someone who had submitted an initial application. And so I did trace that back after investigating to an applicant named Ashley Fiorelli. So then that compelled, you know, me and Zakiya, of course, to, you know, try to ascertain what might have, you know, compelled this. She had submitted an application in December. The application was, you know, incomplete at that point in time when I received the fee dispute. And so, you know, we have to look for, you know, what communications were exchanged, if any, and so forth. So, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into sort of understanding, you know, the background and trying to figure out how did this come to be, right? And so, you know, we really didn't have a whole lot to go on, but this committee and I know the board have, they see this the same way that I do, you know, very consistently and consistent with statute that the application fee is a requirement. It is required to process an application. And there is a reason why we ask for or demand really the fee in conjunction with the submission of an application. No submission of an application. Now with the new system, you don't submit unless you also submit a fee because we have to have that revenue, you know, to cover the cost of processing it, right? And the statute mandates it. So when I realized what we were looking at in terms of someone who had maybe an expectation that the license should have been granted, you know, some statements in the dispute that I found to be not even just problematic, but quite frankly, you know, false statements, misrepresentations of, you know, her efforts to communicate with us about her concern about the charge, you know, what, you know, she expected us to produce. And by when and so forth. You know, I did reach out with a very strongly worded email that, you know, this fee is required. And so, you know, essentially this is a demand for the fee. And what I received in response was, fine, I will, you know, reverse the dispute with my credit card company. And so I waited for, you know, a period of time, you know, to enable that to occur and for the credit card company to notify me that the dispute had been closed and resolved and, you know, it was over. But instead, what happened was that this applicant found a setting in the system which we really didn't, we weren't aware that it was enabled and accessible by the applicant. An applicant can actually click a button that suggests I'm withdrawing my application, even though the application had been submitted. And of course, we've received, you know, consistent advice from Ms. Galvin that only the board can approve a withdrawal of an application. So to suggest that an applicant at any stage can say, you know, never mind, I'm pulling this back and you never saw me, you know, that's, of course, you know, that could never be, that would never be an acceptable practice. So she, instead of submitting the fee, she elected to pursue in her own mind anyway this route. So what we have is a situation where, you know, an applicant clawed back what is a requirement for an application without having, you know, any sort of conversation with anyone on board staff about it, you know, made some false statements to the credit card company about this matter. Made a false statement to me in terms of, you know, how she intended to, you know, resolve this. And then, you know, here we are where, you know, she's of the understanding that this problem has been resolved. And I guess I see it differently. And so how I see it doesn't matter. The committee needs to formulate a recommendation to the board, you know, in terms of how to resolve this. I'll be clear, my my concern is how very easy this is to do, you know, for someone who just notifies their credit card company. I didn't get my license, you know, in such a way that met my expectations. And so, you know, this is my way of resolving it. I'll take my feedback and, you know, I'll move on. That's, you know, completely unacceptable. So the committee could do this. The committee could pursue collection of the fee through certain means. I know that it has always been the case that an Arizona state agency can pursue collections through the Attorney General's office. So we can seek that action. But we could also take more demonstrative action in the form of informing this applicant. You actually don't get to decide that you've withdrawn your application. We are going to forward this matter to the board with a recommendation to deny the application. And so, of course, you know, with that, with the denial comes a whole set of opportunities for her to exercise, you know, due process along the way. But I think it's dangerous for this to be a practice that, you know, the committee sort of is forced to deal with, the committee or the board. This is only the second instance where I've seen this. We did see a psychologist applicant who did the same thing. And what she characterized it as an error, and she fixed the error. Whether that was entirely truthful or not, that's how it was resolved. This is a case where, you know, the applicant is determined to not pay the fee, and she believes she is putting this matter entirely behind her. And I'm hoping that the committee considers anyway setting a different precedent. Any questions about this?
Yes. One, in preparation for this, I went ahead and took a look at this individual's website and trying to understand, you know, what might have led this individual down this path of wanting to apply, then all of a sudden, you know, letting us know, well, you know what, I don't actually need a license, so I'm not going to do anything in Arizona, and then all the other things that Ms. Pekkanen just developed. I have some significant concerns based on the website I reviewed, and I know that was not included in our packet. But I am not of the mindset of just walking away from this. In fact, my initial reaction was a cease and desist of providing any services in the state of Arizona, because what I can read online is pretty much anybody who's looking for a behavior analytic package for the low price of $1,500 can get 8 sessions with her. Well, I have no idea if that's, you know, she's based out of California. I have no idea if that's what her intent was, to start serving people in Arizona, if there was marketing put out in Arizona to be able to draw into her telehealth practice or whatever she's conducting. And so I'm not even up for letting her withdraw her application yet. I somehow want to keep it active so we have some jurisdiction over her, if that's an appropriate mechanism. Miss Galvin, but I also do not believe she should walk away from having started this process and having her fees reversed. The fact that she found a glitch in the matrix to be able to withdraw her her application some way is not the appropriate mechanism for this, and should not be honored in any way, shape, or form. So I don't know if I have questions. I guess I just have a lot of feelings.
And just to be clear, as soon as we discovered, you know, that this was even a possibility that someone could stumble into this utility in the system that we, again, we didn't know was activated, we put in a service ticket to shut that down. So going forward, we shouldn't see this. But again, you know, the potential that someone could just say, no, Capital One, you know, I didn't get what I wanted by the time I expected. So you know, refund me, and, you know, that's the end of the conversation. That's unacceptable.
Yeah. So I guess my question to, I guess maybe Ms. Galvin, is how do we, you know, do we, I mean, obviously we don't want to let her withdraw. I mean, let her just walk away. I think, yes, we need to maintain our right to collect that fee. I think that if we are interested in opening, I don't know if it's opening a complaint or if it's a cease and desist or if it's, I'm not sure what the next step should be. I would be interested in hearing a recommendation, I guess, from you, Ms. Packinen or Ms. Galvin.
I mean, if you believe that there's information that she may be practicing without a license, you could forward that to Heidi, and either the staff could open the complaint or she could put it on the next agenda. You're correct that if there is a possibility that she is practicing without a license, you know, a cease and desist could be an option. But the fact that she has an application pending that could lead to the denial of her application, in addition to the fact that there were items that her application isn't substantively complete, that could also be added to the grounds for denial.
I don't know that I have proof that she's practicing. It raises a lot of questions, and that the website, her website is not grounded to any one particular state, does not reference where she's providing services, and it seems to be open to all, including residents of the state of Arizona. And so I don't know that I have that proof. I think that that's some of the questions I have for this individual. But I do have concerns, granted that they started the process, which makes me think that they at least wanted to provide practice or practice in the state, and then all of a sudden comes to the conclusion that they don't need Arizona licensure. It raises more questions than answers. So if we don't have conclusive proof, is it that we have an application that's open and we invite her to attend and we can ask some questions and find out what's going on?
That is one option, yes. Or if there's there's some indication that she may be holding herself out as a licensed behavior analysis in the state, you could go ahead and open up the complaint and invite her in after her time has run for her to submit a response.
I don't see anything on the website that claims she's licensed to practice in the state of Arizona, so I don't know that it's there. I think it would be more of a invitation to be able to clarify, you know, her application that was put forward, and then now that she's withdrawing it, and understand, you know, and have an understanding that she is not and cannot practice in the state of Arizona. Outside of this fee issue, I just think that I don't know that there's enough information publicly available to open a complaint at this point.
Okay.
Again, I would be happy if board staff, when our investigator returns, if Ms. Michelson wants to take a look and see that there is, I'd be happy to get on board with that path if that's the case.
then I think you could still make the request that she appear before the committee, or just move this to the board with a recommendation that her application be denied because it is incomplete and she didn't respond, that whatever Ms. Pekina needs to do with respect to referral to the AG's office for collection. Is there something else you would need, Heidi?
Madam Chair, no, Ms. Galvin. So the way that I see this then proceeding would be, and let me just make sure that I didn't articulate this. I know I didn't. So the applicant did receive the system-generated notification. Your application has been submitted. In the process of submitting it, we received, certain things from you. There are additional requirements that need to be submitted to complete your file. They consist of these things, and so make sure that these are sourced and submitted to us. So she did receive that information, and so that's why I find her representation of the credit card committee to be false. So she does have a deficient application. The fee is only one such deficiency. There are other materials, of course, that make the application deficient. So moving forward with the recommendation to deny the application on that basis, her decision to claw back the fee in addition to the missing components, all of that form a basis for a denial, absolutely. I see too that the pursuit of the fee is still a legitimate course of action. And so that could still happen in tandem with a possible denial, because no matter what the outcome of this, no matter how this matter is resolved, she never did submit the fee. So I'm prepared to do both if the committee's recommendation is to do that.
I believe that I'm on board with that recommendation.
I think kind of in addition to some of the concerns that we have here, I think we've got some issues with practicing with integrity whenever we look at the core principles of our ethics code. And I'm not saying that these codes are adopted by the board or that we're not addressing this or that, but they still stand in place for a certified behavior analyst. And so whenever we look at this, I'm having a hard time seeing that someone was not acting in a honest and trustworthy manner. I think that there's the aspect of upholding the BACB and other regulatory requirements that kind of come in there. So, I don't know if this is something that other committee members would consider strongly enough to recommend to board staff that they go to the BACB and just kind of inform of this practice, but this behavior in the hands of the BACB in any way. It's just kind of what.
And that referral may come or may be more appropriately made after the board has, finalized its process.
Yeah. And so this would likely, I don't see how this could be prepared in time for the board's next meeting agenda on April 5th, but, and we would provide this person, Ms. Fiorilli, with notice, and so she would have an opportunity to appear before the board. That would afford her some time. So the May, the date eludes me, whatever the May board meeting is, we could schedule it, the committee's recommendation to be considered on that date. And then the agenda item could be inclusive of, Ms. Denton, exactly what you're saying, a possible referral to the BACB. So it would be possible denial, possible pursuit of fee collection through the Attorney General's office and possible BACB referral. So, and maybe Ms. Galvin sometimes embellishes that agenda item with other administrative remedies or something like that. So we'll make sure the bases are covered.
Agreed.
So whenever you're ready to, you know, make that motion, then that's the direction I'll follow, you know, to take it to the board.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, the motion has been made by Dr. Davey. It has been seconded by Dr. Stenhall. Is there any further discussion? Okay. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed? Nay. The motion carries. Okay. We've got two agenda items left on here. I acknowledge we've been on this meeting for 5 hours and 13 minutes. Shall we finish all agenda items today?
Madam Chair, I think we can power through this next one pretty quickly. There are fewer and fewer bills to discuss, but Ms. Malice has something more important to insert.
Probably a code word.
I apologize. Yes, we need another code word, Madam Chair. The next code word is ascending. Ascending. Thanks.
Okay. Agenda item number 14 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding proposed legislation, including the ones that Heidi is about to go over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe just give everyone understands, everyone is aware, you know, what has transpired with respect to House Bill 2068. Is there, you know, any questions or comments about that? About the fact that it is really no longer a viable bill for purposes of this session. So then I've touched on, I believe, already the other few bills that I wanted to talk about. You've heard a little already enough, really, about House Bill 2100. So this is the one that really, you know, throws a whole lot of curveballs, I think, at agencies in terms of, you know, what is substantive, what is administrative for purposes of evaluating applications, permits, you know, and all of those things. So it has, you know, broad and deep implications for all kinds of agencies. So I don't even know, you know, quite how we would there'll be a fiscal impact, but you know how I quantify that. I don't even know. But needless to say, you know what it's leading me to understand is that you know there will be we'll continue to try to resolve, you know, the issues that we just talked about, which is, you know, minimizing application errors, but for those that we continue to find and for which we don't have a solution, they'll be turning into fair letters, you know, without, I think, exception. And so that's going to be, that's something we want to circumvent, you know, with any solution that we can come up with. So watching this bill closely, it was transmitted to the governor 3 days ago. And I believe the governor has 10 days to take action on a bill which may be veto sign, or if no action, it's it does go into effect without signature. That is an option after 10 days, I believe it is. The House Bill 2243, the criminal background background check fix bill, curiously, it's stalled a bit, and I'm not sure that I'm clear why. It hasn't made any forward progress since the majority-minority caucuses met to review it on the 12th. So I don't really know what sort of, you know, why the breaks are have been applied to this bill. I'm trying to get clarity on that, but I don't have that yet. It cleared the chamber of introduction with a virtual unanimous vote. So that's curious to me. Then I think, was there only one more? Oh, Senate Bill 1343. So this is a bill that really, it will task rulemaking agencies, including this one, with, we already have a robust exercise that we need to go through every 5 years to justify every rule that is adopted under that agency's statutory authority. I'm going through this process right now for the psychology rules. 2 years ago, roughly, completed that for the behavior analyst rules. So in addition to what is already required of that process, it introduces a new requirement which compels administrative agencies to, what does it say? To the publish an evaluation of the burdens on similar occupational licenses in all states that border this state and justify any instance where the state imposes a greater burden on a licensee than in its neighboring states. The ambiguity of that is what really troubles me, because that could be framed as simple as their fee is this, our fee is this. And so, you know, this constitutes a greater burden here for LBAs than, oh, hypothetically, Colorado or New Mexico, where there is no fee because they're not licensed. So wait a minute, is that true for New Mexico? Colorado, anyway. So, you know, that's a little concerning, because, you know, that's a criteria that, you know, occurred to me, but in the absence of that sort of being a specific criteria that we are to use, I don't know if that's, you know, something that needs to be considered as part of this exercise. And there's a whole host of other factors too, where it's not as simple as saying, you know, our regulatory burden consists of this and we quantify it, but how do I know the regulatory burden in Utah? I mean, I just, what is required and what is necessary for that exercise to be complete and accurate and representative and defensible? You know, I struggle with this, because I think there, it just raises so many questions about how do we even possibly approach this exercise, and how do we comply? And how do we do it in such a way that it isn't expensive? Because I think it would be, you know, incredibly expensive to bring in someone, you know, to do a fairly decent job of conducting this kind of analysis. So this bill was transmitted to the governor 2 days ago, and I'm not sure that this piece of it is really understood, or maybe I'm just overthinking it, but, you know, my default setting is, you know, to really think about this and its implications. And this is what I'm coming up with. Dr. Davey, did you have something profound to say? Do you have the solution that I don't?
Oh. I wish you did. It's just, it's baffling the ambiguity of which this is laid out and left to the various bodies to then try to interpret what this is going to, how this is going to be. You're going to, with the ambiguity, everybody's going to turn something different in. Like, without a matrix to work off of, how do you compare board to board? Like, I would think that it's too bad there's not like an association of the wards to get together and say, all right, here's how we're going to respond to this. And, you know, maybe that's something you can talk to your fellow, you know, executive directors about, you know, do we come up with some ground rules so that we all at least are turning in, you know, similar, you know, sections, similar data, similar assessments versus what is bound to be the wild, wild west of a report. Like, is there any way to go back and see clarification I mean, you can do this, I guess, from the psych, I guess the psychologist may have different, like the full board may have different feelings, but I would think that getting some clarity would be helpful for everyone.
Madam Chair, Dr. Davey, absolutely. So one possibility would be, I would hope that the Governor's Regulatory Review Council, who is tasked with reviewing 5-year rule reports, that they promulgate rules that prescribe exactly what it is that, you know, you are questioning, I am questioning, which is, okay, the statute doesn't state, you know, what the criteria need to consist of for purposes of completing this exercise. So the rulemaking will. So it may be that there's, you know, a delay until, you know, we sort of see, oh, okay, this is what was meant. So, you know, these are the, this is what we research and this is what we produce. So that may happen. What I also, I have to wonder this, that an extremely large agency like the Department of Health Services or the Department of Economic Security, the hundreds of thousands of, you know, rules under their authority, under their statutory authority, you know, as the magnitude of this task for us is multiplied many, 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 many times over. So I would think those agencies, you know, they are probably grappling with this issue as well. What, if anything, you know, they are thinking, or, you know, what they're articulating about it, I haven't heard, but I would be shocked if, you know, this question hasn't been, you know, these questions haven't been swirling around and, you know, there are no answers. So it will be interesting to see, you know, what the outcome of this bill is to it in that, in a much bigger context than we are. And that's all I had.
So you said department, like, what about access? Are they on the hook for this as well?
Yeah, I mean, any state agency, if you look at the Arizona Administrative Code, there are, I don't know, Gene, how many thousands of rules, how many, you know, thousands of pages. It's, and I think in almost all cases, it's rare for rules to not be subject to this 5-year review exercise, right? I mean, most rules. You're muted, Ms. Galvin. I think most rules are required to go through this 5-year review process, if not all of them.
I was just going to say, how many volumes of the administrative code are there?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
The 5-year rule review exercise is daunting in and of itself. Ours is due in a month, and I can't tell you how many hours I've already put into it, and I still have a little to complete. But this just it increases the workload by a factor of 10 easily. So with that, that's all I have.
Agenda item number 15 is new agenda items for future meetings. I know we've discussed a couple of them already throughout this meeting before getting to this agenda item, but do any remain undiscussed and in need of being added for future agenda items? Okay. Seeing none, we will move on to agenda item number 16, which is adjournment. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
The motion to adjourn has been made by Dr. Davey. It has been seconded by Dr. Stenhoff. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we will take a vote. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.